square. It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Good evening and welcome to We Decide America at the Crossroads, live coverage of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, Illinois. Broadcasting live from the studios of WLPN, LP Chicago, 105.5 FM, Lumpen Radio, I'm Jenna Flanagan.
And I'm Shali Pittman. Welcome to day three of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, Illinois.
The theme of tonight is a fight for our freedoms, and tonight we'll be looking at the ways those freedoms play out in the Democratic platform. And tonight, Minnesota Governor and Vice Presidential nominee Tim Walz is expected to take the stage for the biggest speech of his political life. And other high-profile speakers will include, preceding him, will include former President Bill Clinton, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, and former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, among others.
And yesterday, during day two of the DNC, a ceremonial roll call of all 50 states and U.S. territories confirmed Vice President Kamala Harris as the Democratic nominee. That vote confirmed what had been decided earlier this month with a virtual vote, which confirmed VP Harris less than 2 weeks after President Biden dropped his reelection bid. Democrats turned their roll call into a dance party with state-specific songs, and Illinois Governor J.P. Pritzker, who's worth several billion dollars through the Hyatt Hotel chain, also took aim at the former Trump administration.
I had to govern for 2 years while Trump was president. Let me tell you what's embarrassing. In Illinois, we passed a massive bill to fix our roads and bridges. When Donald Trump proposed his own plan, he turned right around and called it stupid. We eliminated the grocery tax. Donald hasn't been in a grocery store since his first bankruptcy. Illinois invested in clean energy and the jobs it brings. Donald claimed that windmills in the ocean made the whales a little batty. During COVID, we supported small businesses and jobs. And Donald? Well, Donald told us to inject bleach.
Last night, we also heard from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who was backed by the slogan, Strong Middle Class, Strong America. Recalling the state of the economy when the Biden-Harris administration came into power, before lauding the improvements that were accomplished.
A nation suffering, a nation frightened, and people looking to their government for support. And within 2 months of taking office, our government did respond. We passed the American Rescue Plan, which provided $1,400 for every man, woman, and child in the working class.
And towards the end of his time at the podium, Senator Sanders addressed an issue that's been relatively overlooked in the first 2 days of the DNC, the ongoing war in Gaza. These remarks brought on some of the most thunderous cheers of the night.
We must end this horrific war in Gaza. Bring home the hostages and demand an immediate ceasefire.
Concluding the evening was a tag team performance from former First Lady Michelle Obama. Oh, and her husband, former President Barack Obama.
That other guy.
Yeah. After roughly a minute of unrelenting cheers and applause, the former First Lady criticized former President Trump's record in the Oval Office, and she implored the American people to hold strong and to quote-unquote do something. She also built up VP Harris's candidacy, saying that she and Harris are cut from the same cloth, alluding to the matriarchs in both of their lives.
Kamala Harris is more than ready for this moment. She is one of the most qualified people ever to seek the office of the presidency. And she is one of the most dignified. A tribute to her mother, to my mother, and to your mother too. The embodiment of the stories we tell ourselves about this country. Her story is your story. It's my story. It's the story of the vast majority of Americans trying to build a better life. Look, Kamala knows, like we do, that regardless of where you come from, what you look like, who you love, how you worship, or what's in your bank account, we all deserve the opportunity to build a decent life. All of our contributions deserve to be accepted and valued. Because no one has a monopoly on what it means to be an American. No one.
Former President Obama spoke next, claiming to be, quote, the only person stupid enough to speak after Michelle Obama. He also castigated Donald Trump, emphasizing that America needs to avoid a, quote, unquote, sequel of his presidency. And he asked folks to invest their time and resources in the Harris-Walz campaign, who he says would leave the country better than they found it.
That is what this election is about. And I believe that's why if we each do our part over the next 77 days, if we knock on doors, if we make phone calls, if we talk to our friends, if we listen to our neighbors, if we work like we've never worked before, if we hold firm to our convictions, we will elect Kamala Harris as the next president of the United States and Tim Walz as the next vice president of the United States. We will elect leaders up and down the ballot who will fight for the hopeful, forward-looking America we all believe in. And together, we too will build a country that is more secure and more just, more equal, and more free. So let's get to work. God bless you. And God bless the United States of America.
Meanwhile, last night, the Chicago Police Department arrested between 55 and 60 protesters who were demonstrating outside the Israeli consulate in Chicago's West Loop. Chicago police arrested demonstrators put forth different narratives. Chicago Police Superintendent Larry Snelling said protesters had been given ample warning that police attempted de-escalation, but that this contingent of protesters wanted a confrontation.
We declared a mass arrest after our officers were physically confronted and attacked. We were not the initiators of violence, but we responded to it.
The protest was organized by a group called Behind Enemy Lines, which promoted the rally by invoking the bloody DNC of 1968. In a protest on social media, the group urged a direct confrontation and said that protests outside of the convention center weren't enough and urged the DNC to be shut down and to, quote, refuse to engage with careerists and opportunists, unquote. In a press conference this morning, Superintendent Snelling said the police wouldn't change their strategy after last night. Three journalists were among the dozens arrested, and Snelling attempted to explain the rationale for that this morning.
We have journalists. We won't allow you to do your jobs. We really do. But there are times when we're calling a mass arrest or we're attempting to move in, we need you guys to step to the side. If you don't do that, it's obstructing us And it makes it harder for us to take the people into custody that we're attempting to take into custody. And what we don't want is for you to get caught in the middle of it and get injured and hurt. So if you're not moving, if you're not complying with our orders at that time, you may be breaking the law yourselves.
Meanwhile, demonstrations continued in the city this afternoon. The Chicago Coalition for Justice in Palestine was slated to kick off a protest this afternoon in Union Park, a hub for this week's protest just outside the United Center. More protests, including the March on the DNC, are scheduled there for tomorrow. Tonight's theme of the Democratic National Convention, A Fight for Our Freedoms. And tonight, we'll look at the various freedoms enjoyed or not enjoyed by the people of this nation. More after this.
The great state of Illinois, the Prairie State, home of four presidents, including President Barack Obama, the birthplace of skyscrapers and the adopted home of Superman. The cornerstone of the Midwest Blue Wall, the first state to ratify the 13th Amendment ending slavery, and the 19th Amendment granting women the right to vote. Illinois casts one vote present and 176 votes for the next president of the United States. Future Madam President Kamala Harris!
That was J.B. Pritzker during the ceremonial roll call vote last night over the Alan Parsons Project song, Sirius, which was also the intro to the Chicago Bulls. All right. So now we turn to convention correspondent Bob Henley. He's live on the floor at the United Center and is here to give us a sense of what's already happened and a preview of what's still in store for the delegates. Bob, you there?
You can hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, Bob. We made contact. Yes.
Yes.
All right, so yes, give us a preview. We're dying to know.
Well, so also, just a very emotional moment happened when Senator Booker from New Jersey, who's been kind of like an impromptu MC, introduced the parents of American Israeli hostage Hirsch Goldberg, Poland, John and Rachel's parents, addressed the Democratic National Convention to a standing ovation and a spontaneous chant of "Bring them home, bring them home." Their reference to a possible ceasefire brought a wave of loud applause. Tonight's headliners, Jenna, include former President Bill Clinton, former Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, and, of course, Vice President Harris's pick for Vice President Minnesota, Governor Tim Walz. Earlier tonight, we heard from Cecile Roberts, former Planned Parenthood president, and other activists who had hit the loss of reproductive rights in the context of the nation's theme of freedom, as you were saying, which reinforced the message with the playing of John Batiste's infectious freedom as a kind of anthem. Speakers linked protecting and advancing gay marriage, LGBTQ rights into the same overarching narrative. Now, we heard from Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson. There was a flashback. And Representative Tom Suozzi, who delighted Democrats recently when he flipped his Long Island district from red to blue with a major labor union assist when he took the immigration issue head on. Now, well, it's funny. I spoke one-on-one with a Minnesota delegate who said he was proud of his state's contribution to the national ticket, but expressed disappointment at where the delegation was seated on the floor, which he said was because his state, get this, was not a swing state. Yet from the reporting that we've been doing all week, Walz's biography, which includes being born in Nebraska and working as a beloved teacher and high school football coach in, get this, Cherry County, that has a population of 5,500 people and 87% of voters voted for former President Trump. This guy is king in that county. And it's important to know, Jenna and Charlie, that key states like North Carolina, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan have rural places just like Cherry County. So this could be the swing vote of all time. Consider that in 2016, Trump won by just 10,000 votes. this is the same kind of thing that Reverend Barber talks about when he says,
I was going to say that.
Yes, if you see a theme here, 87 million low-wage and low-wealth voters, a majority of whom did not vote in 2016. And when we surveyed them, what we found out from the Columbia University thing is nobody had spoken to them. So it seems like Democrats want to open up that conversation.
Yeah, well, it seems as if, because when people talk to voters, the overriding theme that you always get is economic distress. And the question is, who's going to help me more? So that seems to fit with what we've been hearing from voters. And it sounds like what the Democratic Party is attempting to present.
Well, and it's true that one of the things about this hometown hero, that Governor Walz has really gone through a kind of transformation in many ways, of course. Being from a state and a rural area where hunting is big and it's a big part of the culture, he went from being a, NRA A-plus to like a failure because after a mass shooting, he had a change of heart publicly. And this is the kind of thing we never see in politics. He gave the money back to the NRA. Or turned it into charity. I got to find out about that, but I know that he disowned them entirely, which was...
Well, either way, he gave up the money, which is, that's something unique, let's say. We don't normally see that. So when it comes to the convention that's taking place, I mean, you mentioned Cory Booker, Tom Suozzi, and some other politicians. But I'm wondering, was there anybody else notable who's already been on stage?
Well, like, I would say that there was, of course, a lot of people who were activists like Emily's List. And again, this theme of the loss of reproductive rights under Donald Trump, hanging that around him. Because when I talked to the governor of Kansas, Governor Kelly, who is a Democrat, remember that big vote that got the political class's attention. When across party lines, people in Kansas held up the idea that reproductive freedom transcends party ideology. It's a core thing. In the American narrative, we've been slow to move forward, but we never had such a step backward. And that's the kind of thing that I think is creating a new calculus for Democrats.
So now, when it comes to the theme of the night, a fight for our freedoms, this seems like the Democratic Party attempting to reestablish itself and perhaps step on what was once considered Republican territory.
Right. Well, taking words back like freedom, because that's something that's kind of like the MAGA libertarian thing, right? Reclaiming the concept of freedom as extending to, as Governor Walz says, the old tradition of mind your own business. The idea that we can all get along and let each other live our lives. And then, oh, by the way, that 2025 book, that big prop, it keeps coming out on stage.
All right. Well, that's our convention correspondent, Bob Henley. You've heard a lot from him, and you'll hear from him again. We'll be coming back to Bob a little bit shortly. All right. Now we're going to start with the freedom to come, a very important freedom that established this country itself, and that's the freedom to even come here. Last month during the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, former President Donald Trump vowed to renew brutal deportation policies for millions of immigrants. But both political parties have failed to talk about immigration policy and address the impacts of immigration. Democrats this week have touted their own policies at the border with President Joe Biden celebrating his executive action to block asylum seekers at the border.
And unlike Trump, we will not demonize immigrants, saying they're the poison of blood of America, poison the blood of our country. Kamala and I are committed to strengthening legal immigration, including protecting dreamers and more.
Vice President turned Democratic nominee Kamala Harris is vowing to hire thousands of border agents if elected. Now, meanwhile, she also faced criticism from Republicans for her handling of the border. Republicans, particularly Texas Governor Greg Abbott, has used people crossing the border as a political football, if you will, or a political point to be made. Yesterday, Bob Henley, our correspondent at the floor, caught up with members of the Democratic Party at McCormick Place, the largest convention center in North America, where delegates are holding daytime programming. And there, he caught up with New York City Council member Keith Powers at McCormick Place.
So, I'm speaking with City Councilmember Keith Powers from New York City.
So there's a lot of conversation around immigration here, and of course it's something that you guys dealt directly with Governor Abbott sending immigrants in a kind of cynical ploy to try to, I guess, collapse your social safety net. I don't know what. What do you, do people ask you about that here? Has that been something they encountered from other states, from border states? Is it start of the conversation?
It's there's a lot of starts of the conversation, including things like reproductive rights and supporting the middle class and taking down the cost of living. But immigration, as we know, is going to be a big part of the conversation in this year's election. And what we see is the Democratic Party, I think, is willing to make changes to the laws to better accommodate the year 2024. While seeing a Republican Party but also to welcome people and offer opportunity to people who want to be here and be part of our workforce. On their hand, we see a very cynical Republican Party who's decided that busing people around the country is better than offering them opportunity and making better sense of the laws. It's going to be a really clear contrast and compare, I think, at this convention.
So in covering it every day from City Hall, I guess it was as bad as people who weren't properly prepared for winter being sent up in summer clothes. I think you guys said in the middle of winter with no proper overcoat?
Look, what I would say is that no matter what your politics are, you still have to have humanity. And what we've seen from Republicans, especially in the southern states, we've seen a very lack of humanity, treating human beings like their lives don't matter here and that they can send them anywhere without the proper protections or resources to be able to survive. Like I said, there is a big conversation to be had in this country around how to fix our immigration system, how to offer the right opportunities to people, and how to modernize our laws. We're not seeing that from the Republican Party right now. We're seeing cynical tricks. What we're seeing from the Democratic Party is actual bills and solutions and ideas to be able to do both, to address the border crisis and also offer people opportunities and a pathway here so they can build a life.
So I've been doing this for a while. So when I started reporting 30, 40 years ago, over 2,000 homicides a year in New York. Mm-hmm. Now it gets close to like 400 or 500 people are nervous. The one thing that happened was that New York City's secret sauce was that undocumented people who had faith, family, and work restored New York City. Is that part of the thing that's not told about the power of this, if folks can get working?
The story of the United States of America and the story of New York City is people who are coming here to have a better life for them and their family, want to be part of our workforce, want to be part of our value system, and see the United States for what it is. It's a great country with great opportunity. And our history here in New York City has been embracing those individuals and welcoming them and creating a pathway for them. And it seems like in many parts of our country, we're losing that value. That people coming here because they understand it's the greatest country in the world is a good thing, not a bad thing. And we have to have a system that allows for a pathway to that and a functioning pathway.
Do you see now, though, with the turn of the generations and with Vice President Harris being selected to lead the ticket, that that affirms that message in a way?
We are affirming a message that we want to have a good functioning immigration system where people can come here and be part of the middle class, be welcomed, while also making better sense of all the sort of modern iterations of this. I think we have put bills out. We've been rejected. It's been very political. And what we all see often is that Democrats are offering to make a deal around something that we think would work. And this is a keystone issue for the Republican Party, so they don't want to compromise. They want to run on an agenda that...
The dysfunction.
Yeah.
Thank you, Councilman.
Yeah.
I'll see you in City Hall. Take care.
Here in Chicago earlier this month, five recently arrived migrants filed a lawsuit against Chicago police officers, Home Depot employees, and other security personnel. Now, they say they were physically assaulted and verbally harassed with racial insults over the last year by police officers working at the store. Arrests are increasingly a risk for migrant day laborers in Chicago as they try to seek legal work or authorization. They are five of the millions of lives impacted by the political conversation over immigration in the 2024 presidential race. So for more on this story, we turn it over to WORT senior reporter Carlos Davalos. Carlos.
Thank you, Jenna. We are here in the studio with Miguel Alvelo Rivera of the Latin Union of Chicago, which, along with the Raise the Floor Alliance and the People's Law Office, filed that lawsuit. In the lawsuit, they laborers alleged that, like Jenna just said, were beaten up and handcuffed and taken into the store by Chicago police moonlighting as security guards. The lawsuit identifies two Chicago police officers, two Office Depot workers, and the store in the lawsuit. Thank you so much, Miguel, for being with us in the studio. As a local organizer and leader, can you share with us the details of the circumstances behind that lawsuit?
Yeah, so this is following, I think, months of increased tensions at different Home Depots throughout the city of Chicago. And at Latino Union, we are the only worker center in the city of Chicago that does outreach directly to day laborers throughout the Chicago area. And in one of our outreach days, we started hearing from folks that they were being grabbed by security personnel and brought in to the Home Depot and being beaten and being insulted and abused in different ways. So shortly after that, we went again to the site and were actually able to witness a scuffle between security personnel and the day laborers. That's when we reached out to our allies at the Raise the Floor Alliance and got connected with their legal team, after which we did a thorough investigation, and that's where you get what's in the evidence that's presented in the lawsuit.
By the way, the lawsuit also accuses the Chicago Police Department and Home Depot of working together to interfere.
Yes.
What would you... it's clear that for both parties, migration is not a priority. Mm-hmm. However, we can safely argue that in the past, the Republicans have been a bit more sympathetic. Current Republican leadership is directly attacking migration. On the other side, on the Democratic side, the narrative has been pro-migration. However, if we go to the numbers, we can see that, for example, in the first 3 years of President Barack Obama's term, 1.8 million migrant workers were deported. Mm-hmm. So, what are, in your view, the measurements that both parties should take in this issue?
Yeah, I want to emphasize what you just shared. And, you know, I don't know how to say this in English, so I'll say it in Spanish. Está dando al clavo with the difference, right? You're pointing to the big point. The difference there is narrative. Because in practice, both parties have been consistently anti-migrant. And I have to emphasize that this is not just a discussion about national policy. It is also about international policy and how the United States operates in countries throughout the world, not just Latin America, but Africa, Southeast Asia, and how that leads folks into situations of deep necessity where they have to move to places like the United States to try to survive. A lot of folks continue this narrative, right, that the United States is a country of immigrants. And while there is truth to that, out of that narrative is also ignored the fact that the United States is a settler colonial project and that immigration fits into that project. And what we're seeing now is both the strategic use of migrants as this reserve labor force that can be exploited for the benefit of corporations and the advancement of that colonial project, at the same time as you're seeing the exclusion of migrants into the welfare state that is supposed to be available to anybody that lives in this country. So we kind of have this dichotomy, right, of between rhetoric and action, and both parties are completely engaged in that.
Would it be safe to say that this is a national circumstance? This has happened throughout the whole United States.
Yes.
And what would be, in your view, the solution to solve this contradiction between actions, real actions, and the narrative?
So it would be putting the words that supposedly are the foundation of this country into action, creating real integrated systems of support for everybody. Folks that are born in the United States, folks that come to the United States, having real systems of support that can help the people that are here and integrate new folks in a society, right, that that prioritizes human well-being and mutual support above anything else.
Okay. Thank you so much, Miguel. This is Miguel Albelo Rivera, Executive Director of the Chicago Latino Union, a community-based working and doing fantastic, amazing work here in the Chicago area. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
All right. Definitely thank you, Miguel. That was WORT Senior Reporter Carlos Davalos. Thank you.
Thank you, Jenna.
Always been here by the Galactic Unity Ensemble from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Vice Presidential Nominee,
Presidential Nominee,
Kamala Harris traveled to the city yesterday during the second day of the convention. And we turn now to the freedom to choose and the freedom to access reproductive health care.
Yeah, that's right. Roe v. Wade was overturned while Democrat President Biden was in the Oval Office. But the new party platform approved on Monday puts the blame on former President Trump, writing that he appointed three Supreme Court justices during his tenure and shifted judicial power to the far right. During tonight's DNC programming, speakers are expected to address both the Supreme Court and reproductive rights.
Meanwhile, abortion rights activists have largely backed the Harris campaign, pointing to her strong pro-choice stance since the Dobbs decision in 2022.
Tim Walz affirmed the Women's Caucus yesterday morning that people would be free to make their own reproductive decisions under a Harris presidency. The pro-Palestinian protesters disrupted his address just minutes later, accusing the Democratic Party of turning their backs on the women of Gaza.
Pacifica reporter Ann Garrison brings us the latest on pro-Palestine protests during the DNC.
Hundreds of protesters gathered outside the Israeli consulate in downtown Chicago last night, nearly 2 miles from the Democratic National Convention at the city's United Center. The protesters waved Palestinian flags and signs demanding an end to U.S. weapons transfers to Israel. Bicycle police lined the sidewalks on either side of the block, and police in full riot gear assembled at each intersection, kettling the protest with up to 1,000 officers. At one point, a line of protesters marched into one of the riot police lines, leading to arrests. It wasn't possible to see how many were arrested, and ultimately the remaining crowd was allowed to disperse. Local media reported that between several and 70 protesters were arrested, and the Chicago Police Department was unresponsive as to the number. Here's the sound of protesters clashing with police. The protesters were joined by three members of Naturi Karta, which means Guardians of the City, an Orthodox Jewish group holding signs denouncing the Israeli state and its war in Gaza. Here's Rabbi David Weiss, spokesman for the group.
And we're here in Chicago now by Democratic Convention because it's our critical obligation to plead with the political leaders that they should stop being intimidated, they should stop supporting something which common sense dictates that it is unjust, that it is ungodly. If it wouldn't be for the pressure of AIPAC and all the Israeli lobbyists and all their powers, then it would be a simple issue for people to understand that it is criminal, that it is a ghastly crime what they're doing to the people in Gaza. The only reason that this is different than any other world of crime is because the power of the Zionist lobby, the fear of somehow being considered anti-Semitic. Now, this is an insult to basic logic. You find on the college campuses, you will find that tens of thousands of Jewish students are the ones who are opposing the occupation. You find that God-fearing religious communities are opposed to the occupation. Are we anti-Semitic? So how dare they use this weapon, this charge of anti-Semitism, to justify and to condone and to cover for this giving of arms, giving of to constantly bombard and kill the people of Gaza.
Earlier in the day, Medea Benjamin and several other members of Code Pink were dragged out of a room where Vice Presidential nominee Tim Walz was speaking to the Democratic Women's Caucus at McCormick Place. Here are their voices.
Palestine is a feminist issue.
Stop killing women in Gaza.
Stop killing women in Gaza.
Stop killing women in Gaza.
Arms embargo now.
Those were sounds of ongoing protests at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. For Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
Well, for more on reproductive health care, we turn to Chicago's West Loop, where if you walk down the area's side streets and pass some warehouses earlier this week, you might have noticed a van that read, "Healthcare, no matter where." This isn't just an advertisement, it's Planned Parenthood Great Rivers Mobile Clinic. Great Rivers typically provides reproductive care to under-resourced patients in Missouri and southern Illinois, but they made their way up to the city this week, offering free medication abortion, emergency contraception, and vasectomies.
Ah, yes, the other kind of contraception.
Got the snip.
There you go. While the staff was in between patients yesterday, senior reporter Faye Park stepped inside the van to speak with Dr. Colleen McNichols, the chief medical officer at Planned Parenthood Great Rivers.
We are excited to have the opportunity to bring the mobile unit to provide, over the last 2 days, free vasectomy and free medication abortion services.
And so have folks taken you up on the offer? What's the response been?
We actually made the appointment slots available last week, and really within 48 hours, the appointments filled up. We have seen so many examples of how pregnancy care in general has been impacted by abortion bans and abortion restrictions. Folks not able to get care for things like miscarriage management or ectopic pregnancies, people who can't plan healthy pregnancies because they don't have access to care, folks needing to travel thousands of miles to get just basic health care. You know, Illinois is a great example of preparing for the decision. You know, the folks in Illinois did a lot of work to make sure that the state was ready to assume responsibility for the many states it's surrounded by in the South to act as a haven for patients who are needing to travel to Illinois for care. You know, the mobile unit is a great example of how when you are practicing in a state that has scientifically grounded healthcare policy, that you can be innovative, you can do things differently, you can bring healthcare to people instead of always making people jump through hoops to get the healthcare that they need.
Tolcan told Faye Parks yesterday that Into Action was created in order to foster dialogue on the top issues in this year's election, adding that she hopes the festival will inspire people to get out and vote, regardless of affiliation and party.
I think this art is reflective of what's at stake in this election, which is so much. And there's so many things that affect our daily lives that hopefully send a message to the people who come and experience this, that it's worth participating because a lot of big decisions are kind of on the line.
Now, the pop-up gallery is displaying paintings, photographs, and sculptures exploring topics like policing, immigration, and the war in Gaza.
One performance piece by Chicago-based artist Michelle Hartney features three rows of hangers loaded down with hundreds of hospital gowns. According to the accompanying plaque, the piece is called Mother's Right and is drawing attention to the United States' high maternity mortality rate. It also points out that black pregnant people are four times more likely to die in childbirth than their white counterparts.
And outside the building, next to Planned Parenthood's mobile clinic and across from a food truck, is a giant inflatable IUD named Frida Womb.
Meanwhile, pro-life protesters gathered outside the fence, writing messages like, "Protect tiny Chicagoans," and Thrive Nation, a pro-life organization, parked their own mobile clinic across the street.
That's where Faye Parks met Bridgen Van Means, Thrive Nation's CEO, who said that they offer free ultrasounds and counseling on adoption for what they've dubbed, quote, authentic choice. And she added that she didn't see many patients show up to get care at Planned Parenthood's mobile clinic, and that the festival is trivializing reproductive health care.
The key is that, you know, this is a complex situation, and these women take it very seriously. So I think if you send out this message of like a carnival and a circus and hot dog coupons, I don't think that's really how women feel, and it's not really resonating. So we're kind of happy to see that.
And here's Dr. McNichols again.
Abortion care and reproductive health care is a serious topic. I certainly don't disagree with that. However, the assumption that you can't have serious care or safe care in an environment like this is just wrong. You know, healthcare has changed so much over the last decade, and we are actually using things like mobile care or virtual care to address so many healthcare gaps and disparities. And there's no reason that we shouldn't be using it for sexual and reproductive health care as well.
Now, our reporter Faye Parks asked Bridget Van Means, the pro-life activist, to share her thoughts on the mobile clinic's free vasectomy service.
When people come to us with those sorts of questions, it's not in our area of specialty, so we refer them back to their doctors. We really don't comment on it.
Van Means went on to say that she doubted men would be willing to get a vasectomy in a parking lot.
But Dr. McNichols said that their free vasectomies this week have been an especially popular option.
You know, one of the things we have heard from patients over and over again just in these last 2 days is, particularly our vasectomy patients, is they wanted this service for so long, but because they don't have insurance or their insurance doesn't cover it, that they haven't been able to afford it.
Now, Jenna, the new Democratic platform lists restoring Roe v. Wade as a top priority, but Dr. McNicholas says that she wouldn't wouldn't necessarily fix the issue of healthcare access in the United States.
Look, there are healthcare shortages across the country. There has been, even before Dobbs, some real maternity deserts. And we're talking about a public health system in which the United States has really a quite abysmal maternal mortality rates. And so we have compounding public health crises right now where people don't have access to OBGYN care, where their access to that care is restricted and limited by abortion bans and restrictions for care even beyond abortion. So, you know, we are certainly in a time where folks are facing some real healthcare crises, but we also have opportunities right now to address those and fix those issues in ways that give everybody access where they are when they need it.
And Dr. McNicholas says Harris has approached reproductive healthcare with a bigger picture perspective.
Vice President Harris has met with impacted people. I myself have met with her twice as a provider. She has met with patients who have been impacted and providers, clinics who are providing the care. I think it's really easy to demonize care and to make some superficial policy solutions when you don't understand the impact of those solutions. But she has been listening. And so what I am really looking forward to is seeing how the policies that she puts forward do center the patients who are impacted, does center the folks who have been left behind, marginalized folks, black and brown folks, folks who have been unable to afford health care, the folks who have had to travel, and those of us who live this experience with patients every day.
The mobile clinic's appointments are all booked up, but Into Action 2024 pop-up will be in the West Loop through this Thursday, and it's open to the public, but an RSVP is required.
And we turn now to convention correspondent Bob Hennelly. He's live on the floor at the United Center and is here to catch us up on what's happened in the past half hour. Hi, Bob.
We really kind of shifted down. There was what is kind of like triggering tape from January 6th that I'd not seen before in the montage. It was just really violent and reminding the catch reminded us that 9 people had been killed related to that day. And then also that 1,500 people had been charged. And it was just they replayed and juxtaposed Donald Trump's speech from the ellipse where he was so menacing about Vice President Pence. And then when they showed the violence that some of which I don't think mass audiences have seen the way it was spliced together. You had Donald Trump saying that, you know, juxtaposing him saying that everything was fine. These were loving, peaceful people like on a sightseeing tour. Of course, then they produced Olivia Troy, who was Vice President Pence's national security advisor and identified herself as a conservative Republican Latina from Texas. And then she went into some Spanish to make the case. And she said what terrifies her at night is what happens if Trump gets reelected. And according to her quote, there will be no guardrails at all. And so she gave the Harris-Walz her full throated endorsement. She said, we don't agree on all issues, but the most important thing, protecting our freedom, we agree on. And then they just produced also former Lieutenant Governor of Georgia, Jeff Duncan, who also came out and said, yes, I'm a Republican, but I'm voting for Harris. And so now Andy Kim has come out, the representative from New Jersey, who's running for the U.S. Senate. He is the representative you may remember. An AP photo captured him spontaneously helping the janitorial staff of the Capitol cleaning up after that catastrophic mess. So like I say, it's been a real downshift.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, Bob, after the past 2 days. Bob, I want to ask you, there's been an army of anti-Trump Republicans speaking over the past few days, including yesterday, Stephanie Grisham, former White House press secretary under former President Trump. Did you happen to catch that? What has been, how many former Trump administration personnel have there been on the stage?
I would say that right now what they're doing is blending together law enforcement, also some of the Capitol Police, described in just chilling detail, being beaten with flagpoles, with the American flag, some of them with the blue and white signature, Blue Lives Matter. And there was a spontaneous, of course, applause for these Capitol Police officers, many of whom were traumatized and permanently disabled by what happened that day.
All right, convention correspondent Bob Hennelly. Bob, we'll check in with you in just a couple dozen minutes, okay?
Thanks.
It was me who plowed the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. Now we stand outcast and starving, midst the wonders we have made. But the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever.
That was Sarah Nelson, the president of the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, singing the anthem Solidarity Forever at an event put on by the Progressive Democrats of America, or PDA, just before the convention.
Now, that event was called Progressive Central, and it was pitched as a progressive counter to the DNC. And they've been holding it during every DNC for the past 20 years, bringing together progressives from across the nation in the DNC host city. This year, while the DNC is in Chicago, the PDA held their Progressive Central on Sunday and Monday at the Chicago Teachers Union. WORT senior reporters Carlos Davalos, Sarah Gabler, and Faye Parks attended these events, and they watched progressive leaders like Representative Chuy Garcia, Representative Ro Khanna, Senator Bernie Sanders, Rep. Pramila Jayapal, Rep. Dila Ramirez, and many more who sent the message that progressives should push for policy change and not just promises. These speakers reiterated that progressive policies like universal health care are popular with Americans.
But to get to the meaningful policy changes, we do have to address structural racism within the progressive movement, Reverend Lennox Yearwood said on Sunday. He is the president of the Hip Hop Caucus, a national nonpartisan organization that employs young people to participate in the public sphere.
So even here, to come to the DNC, and we're coming here to do get out the vote efforts, so we're coming here to do voter protection. Resources are still not going, because of racism, going to black, brown, and indigenous organizations. And that's a problem. So I do think that for us to deal with what's happening on the outside, we will be much more successful as a movement if we can tear down the structure of racism within our own progressive movement.
Saru Jayaraman is the president of One Fair Wage, an organization of service workers seeking to end the sub-minimum wage. Under a, quote, fair wage, businesses would pay workers a living wage and allow them to take tips on top. Jayaraman spoke about how both the Harris and Trump campaigns are pledging to end the tax on tipped wages. And she says that the real issue on the table is because both candidates are targeting the 14 million restaurant industry workers who don't vote.
First time you've got two people at the top of the Democratic ticket, both of whom come from states that already pay one fair wage. California is a one fair wage state. Minnesota is a one fair wage state. They can make the whole country a one fair wage state. Yeah. But only if we stop talking about just no tax on tips. Do you know that two-thirds of tipped workers don't even earn enough to pay income tax? Is the solution getting rid of taxes, or is it actually paying them a livable wage that would allow them to actually live, that would allow them to engage politically, that would allow them to actually have a life with their families?
Now, the call for fair wages would significantly impact the number of migrants who work in the service industry. This group of workers is under attack by Trump and other Republicans.
Representative Chuy Garcia of Illinois spoke about Trump manipulating the narrative regarding migration.
Trump has weaponized immigration, turning it into a tool of fear.
Trump's tariffs on Mexico are an example of U.S. policy that triggers migration, so says activist and Code Pink co-founder Medea Benjamin, who talked about how sanctions and U.S. international policy are killing people in small countries.
Trump has weaponized immigration, turning it into a tool of fear.
U.S. foreign policy can have a much more aggressive face, says Representative Ro Khan of California. He was one of the Congress members that voted against additional military aid to Israel.
There were 37 of us, Chuy and myself included, Pramila, who you heard from, who voted against giving Netanyahu a blank check.
Now, Representative Khanna also advocated for Palestinian self-determination, adding that the U.S. should be the 144th country to recognize Palestine as a nation.
Just like there is the right for Jewish self-determination and the right for Israel, there has to be Palestinian self-determination for the right to Palestine. We're never going to have peace in the Middle East. And that's why I believe that we need to, as the United States, recognize the state of Palestine like 143 other countries have.
Representative Maxwell Alejandro Frost of Orlando, Florida, also made an appearance at Progressive Central on Monday. He spoke about the freedom from the threat of gun violence.
Because when I think about the issue that got me involved in politics, which is gun violence, I always tell people most gun violence are crimes of condition. People who have been pushed to the brink and feel like they need to use the gun to get ahead. But the goal here should be creating a world where people don't feel the need to use a gun to solve their problems in the first place. So if you want to end gun violence, guess what? You better be for Medicare for All. If you want to end gun violence, you got to be for fighting the climate crisis. If you want to fight gun violence, you got to be for making sure we have livable, thrivable wages, that we defeat poverty. That's how we end gun violence. It's not the issue in and of itself. It's the symptom of root causes. And we all understand that for generations, the right wing, and yes, even many Democrats, would sell people this lie and run on a politics of scarcity, that there's not enough. That if you get something, I must be losing something.
You're listening to live coverage of the Democratic National Convention brought to you by the Pacifica Network and your local community radio station. This is sponsored by the American Federation of Government Employees, representing 750,000 federal workers in all 50 states, 1199 SEIU, the largest union of healthcare workers in the nation, representing 450,000 members, 32BJ SEIU, America's largest building service union, representing more than 175,000 workers in 11 states, and Washington, D.C. When we fight, we win. The Transportation Workers Union of America, representing 155,000 workers in transit, utility, and airline sectors, CWA New Jersey, representing 70,000 public and private sector workers. The United Steelworkers 4200 represents nurses at Robert Wood Johnson University Hospital in New Brunswick, New Jersey. The New York State Nurses Association, the New Jersey HPAE, representing 14,000 nurses and allied healthcare professionals. The Doctors Council, SEIU, the New York Metro Area Postal Union, APWU, AFL-CIO. Teamsters Local 210, New York City's second largest Teamsters Union, CME, DC 37 Local 3621, FDNY, EMS Officers. The U.S. Postal Police Officers Association, the Environmental Benevolent Police Benevolent Association, representing the men and women who protect New York City's vast watershed system, New York City Organization of Public Service Retirees. And we would like to go to...
We are going back to the floor, but first I want to say we're broadcasting live from the studios of Community WLPN LP Chicago 105.5 FM Lumpen Radio. Hey, don't forget to support your community radio station. Jenna and I will be back in just a few minutes, but now we're going to break to the convention floor.
Everybody clapping, pumping their hands, swaying left and right.
Wow. Wow.
Senator Booker. Wow.
I couldn't see the rest of y'all, but from back, Nebraska was getting down. Stevie's song is powerful, but so was his words. He said courage over complacency. He gave us a call in his remarks. But now I gotta tell you, the party is gonna keep going. We're just getting started, y'all. And this is a segment that I am very, very excited about. Because it might be Wednesday night, and we might be in Chicago, but, it's starting to feel like something I've wanted to say my whole life. Live from New York, it's Saturday Night! Please welcome Keenan Thompson!
He points to the left. Keenan Thompson walks on, carrying that big 2025 book mandate for leadership. Khaki pants, a white print top.
Is Matt here? Hey, there he is. Matt, how are you?
On the screen.
All right, Matt. Now, Matt, I understand that you work as an AV tech in Nevada, and you make a decent hourly wage. Is that right? Oh, I don't know if we can hear Matt. Can we hear Matt?
So who's going to fix it? Keep speaking, Matt, so we can hear you. Uh-huh. Okay, that's good. I guess we're going
to... Now a woman on screen. She waves.
This is Becky. Becky, can we hear you?
Hi, Keenan. It's great to be here.
Thank you. All right.
She pumps her arms.
Now, Becky, you're married, correct?
I am. Me and my wife have been together for about...
From Chicago, Illinois, this is We Decide, live coverage of the Democratic National Convention, brought to you by the Pacifica Network and by your local community radio station. Hi, I'm Shally Pittman, here with Jenna Flanagan, and we're live from the studios of Lumpin' Radio, 105.5 FM Chicago, as night three of the DNC continues, Jenna, and where there appear to be technical difficulties and also more props.
Oh, cool. Yeah, they're back with that Project 2025 book, which mm-hmm. they've got open like a tome now on stage with Kenan Thompson. But in all fairness, they had their own technical difficulties with sound. Mm-hmm. And so I feel at one with the convention.
Live radio, live broadcasting.
Exactly.
We identify. And for more who can also identify, we go to Bob Hennelly on the ground to catch us up. Hi, Bob.
So this has been like being on the back end of a runaway train. So Stevie Wonder came out and blew the doors open of the whole place. And he also opened with a really thoughtful, poetic, spiritually centered thing. Like, it was almost like his, he knew what he was going to let loose and so got everybody centered. And then it just came apart. You caught the back end of that. And then, of course, Kenan Thompson came on and is using it now. I think he's got himself. He's got his rhythm. So he's using the 2025 hardbound book, which I think will be available in party papers soon, the DNC edition. And he is having some fun in establishing a kind of interviewing random people about how their life might be affected. It is kind of effective. I won't be as funny as he is, but he's like finding, I guess there was an OBGYN person who started speaking, a woman.
Okay.
And then he just drills them and then looks it up to see, well, how's your life going to be in 2025?
Ah, well, I will say that's actually incredibly effective messaging. You know, the Democratic Party has been bringing this up a lot. Do you see this as being something that they're going to centralize in their campaign, even though the Trump administration, he has said he doesn't even know what it is?
Listen, he's now holding the book up, the 2025 mandate, and it has, like, the cover photo of it. And, of course, now he's going into great detail. He's dropping it. The place is coming apart. Yeah, I do think that it's like, the thing about this is that it, the more that Trump tries to hide it, the larger the book gets. I predict right here, right now,
oh my God,
see something 8 foot tall that is going to be rolled around. I predict that there'll be a trailer in Bedminster that will carry it. They will hang it around his neck. I guess they figure they are really going to turn them into the Whig Party at this point.
Mm.
Well, I mean, it's it definitely seems like effective communication, but bringing out a comedian, though, to make this very serious
right.
point with civilians, as if comedians aren't civilians.
Well, I don't know. The Democratic platform was written in all caps, so it just, you know, I would like to see what...
Well,
yeah, what book they would have used to type that up, to print it in. But, all right, Bob, I mean, how energetic does it feel now? Oh, we just dropped the book on the floor.
I think our feed might be a little bit behind yours, but yeah, we're watching him walk off the stage.
Yeah, and so what's interesting is, like, they heard us, I guess. They heard us because I said, it was a real, I mean, it was upsetting and traumatizing to see that footage and to have the Capitol police officers who have this love in their country, and they were veterans, and to be beaten with the symbol of the country, I mean, that's beyond. And so like I say, they've shifted gears again to kind of bring it forward in, and I guess building towards, I would imagine, that President Clinton will be out next.
Oh, but
is
first,
that who I think it is?
That is, I believe that is Mindy Kaling from The Mindy Project, and a lot of people know her best from The Office.
This is guided television viewing brought to you on the radio.
Yeah, I know. Well, okay, so we've got all the celebrities who are coming out. I will say that there is a noted difference in the laundry list of celebrities that we're seeing tonight for the DNC versus who we saw at the RNC. There's been a lot of talk on social media about that playlist from the roll call yesterday, pointing out that to be able to play that playlist, they had to get the okay from all 50 of those artists, as opposed to, you know, maybe just having a few artists okay their music for a political convention. So we're noticing, like, whereas maybe not every single celebrity has come out and formally endorsed giving a blessing somehow to using their artwork, their music.
Can I tell
seems
my
to
celebrity
be...
story? Can I
absolutely.
Tell my celebrity story? Okay, so listen, I have been close to greatness. In my household, Billy Porter rocks. And so there are not many times as a former classical ballet dancer that I, like, find myself getting caught up in, you know, stardom. But I was online in security line, which means you probably have 15 to 20 minutes of quality time to make an impression on a famous person. And so Mr. Porter was there, and I saw there was a gentleman from the Democratic Finance Committee who I guess has stickers, means he can get in any place here, even behind the velvet rope where the venture capital firms must be kind of making deals. And so I wanted to figure out, how do I approach Mr. Porter, who my family is a big fan of, knowing that I was not going to get the picture of him that my wife wanted and asked me about. So I said, oh, well, listen, I went to Chess Records today, because I did. And he and I started having a nice conversation, and then figuring I had been a good encyclopedia salesman and warned my way into at least his giving me a little bit of tape.
That's what makes you a good reporter, Bob.
Well, not really, because I'm not as good as I think I am on this day. And so I said, well, how about something from Pacifica, WBAI? And he looked like he was going to say something. And then the guy in the suit may have been his agent. He was a finance person. I don't know what from which jurisdiction. He said, no, we're not doing interviews right now. Now, I fell back, did not look like a paparazzi, and the other people came up and, of course, were boorish and took pictures of them. Then I hung back and kind of walked parallel, but not intrusively. And then I heard his finance guy, who was his babysitter, say, we can't be late for the CBS interview. And then I mustered my courage and said, CBS? Really? So I guess I'll never get the interview, but that's what
okay, happened. All right. Well, still, though, we had a non-interaction, but a sighting of Billy Porter.
Well, I have one more question, very important question for the both of you. As you know, as we heard, each state had a song that represented them. I did not feel very represented by Wisconsin's song, which is Jump Around by House of Pain. And I'm wondering if our New Yorkers here feel represented by Empire State of Mind by Jay-Z and Alicia Keys.
You know, okay, I'm probably going to get canceled for this, but this is not the best
Jeffries
offering.
Hakeem Jeffries is on the stage, guys. Yeah. Here comes
Hakeem Jeffries. Okay, this is a representative of New York.
Can we go to that? Can we please? No, is he there?
Let's hear it. Let's hear a teaser. Let's hear a teaser. We go to Hakeem Jeffries.
Really good. And then never take another bite again.
You're going to come, I guess, for having delay factor.
All right. Well, Bob, we are going to go to our next segment, but we will check in with you. Why don't you recap what Mr. Jeffries tells us on the floor, okay?
Oh, you got it.
All right.
Awesome.
Meanwhile, there's so much more to get to, Jenna. Tonight's theme, if you're just joining us here in our DNC coverage, is a fight for our freedoms. And we turn to yet another freedom tonight, the right to enjoy the environment for future generations.
Oof.
It's a big one.
Yeah.
At the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee last month, attendees waved posters and chanted "Drill, baby, drill" on the convention floor. And according to the Brookings Institution, the Trump administration took 74 actions to weaken environmental protections, from rolling back policy to address climate change to deregulatory actions that supported the fossil fuel industry. And in contrast, roughly 10% of the Democratic platform is dedicated to environmental social issues, from supporting clean energy and clean energy jobs to environmental justice and pollution. Environmental groups are declaring their support for Kamala Harris, and one group, Climate Hawks Vote, a California-based PAC that aims to elect outspoken climate leaders, made their first presidential endorsement in the organization's 10-year history. R.L. Miller, the political director of Climate Hawks Vote, spoke at the Progressive Central Conference earlier this week, and here's what she had to say.
We ask politicians to sign a pledge that they will not take money from the oil and gas industry. And we do that simply to get oil money and gas money out of politics. So in 2019, Kamala elected to sign the pledge with me. Right now, you know, fast forward 5 years later, scroll down to Harris Victory Fund in the fine print. It says that the Harris Victory Fund does not take money from named SEC fossil fuel executives.
But indigenous water protectors are concerned about Governor Tim Walz's relationship to big oil. Now, that's because his support of a reconstruction project in Minnesota from Canadian oil and gas company Enbridge. It's the Line 3 pipeline. Though he initially vowed to stop the project when he campaigned for governor in 2017, Walz's administration approved permits for the pipeline in 2020. Paving the way for the massive tar sands pipeline to pass through the treaty-protected lands of several tribes. Gina Petler, a member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Ojibwe, told the independent environmental outlet Heated that, quote, the Native community really showed up and came out with votes in the thousands. And once Walz was elected, they turned around and they approved the permits for Pipeline 3. Then, during the pipeline's construction, water protectors and protesters were met with violent policing, surveillance, and constant harassment. For indigenous water protectors like Peltzer, Walz's record on Line 3 clouds the environmental achievements he's made in the state, like signing legislation requiring carbon-free electricity by 2040.
Meanwhile, here in Chicago, on Tuesday, the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative held an event called Honoring Our Waters, Tribal Connections to Stewardship at the Daly Center Plaza in downtown Chicago. Now, the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative is a multinational coalition of over 240 U.S. and Canadian mayors. They're working together for the protection and restoration of the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence River Basin. Now, these watersheds contain 20% of the world's surface fresh water and provide drinking water for 40 million people. The group includes Mayor Brandon Johnson of Chicago, Mayor Cavalier Johnson of Milwaukee, Mayor Ryan Sorensen of Sheboygan, Wisconsin, among their Canadian and First Nation counterparts. They were all there to roll out an educational map of the basin meant to showcase the indigenous stewardship of these lands by overlaying the waterways with indigenous narratives and words. WRT's senior reporter Sarah Gabler and WZRD's Rylan Pietras attended the event.
Mark Madison, CEO of Swim, Drink, Fish, a Canadian organization, told Pietras that it's important to bring different governing bodies together.
Another issue is the political bifurcation. With eight states, two provinces, and many nations, because Canada and the U.S. are the two big nations, but the indigenous nations, there's over 110, you know, really trying to work together. It's a challenge. This map and this project, its intention, through knowledge, through learning, through experience, to come to a place where we can work together to protect swimmable, drinkable fish water and protect this ecosystem.
Mayor Brandon Johnson addressed the crowd, saying it's crucial to address water infrastructure.
And so today, we demand an end to the pollution of our source water, an end to decades of disinvestment in our water infrastructure, both of which threaten our community's access to clean, safe, and affordable water. But we also have to make sure that we intensify our efforts to respond to climate justice movement. We must make sure that water mismanagement and the misuse of any parts of the U.S., Canada, that we do not become an excuse to pump badness back into the basin.
Now, senior reporter Sarah Gabler spoke with Gina Katkak, the chairwoman of the Menominee tribe, who said that protecting ancestral land from projects like the Back 40 mine, which is an open pit metallic sulfide mine yards from the Menominee River, is crucial to protecting the tribe's culture and history.
Our creation story begins at the mouth of the Menominee River, and that flows into, you know, from Lake Michigan. And so that's important ancestral site for us, and to try and make sure that we protect that area and protect our ancestral land, things that are at risk like the Back 40 mine, and making sure that our story remains strong and our story is being told.
However, those involved with the initiative wouldn't respond to questions about the threat that Enbridge Line 3 and Line 5 pipelines pose to Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Basin. The pipelines run from Alberta, Canada, through Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan before passing back into Canada. And a rupture at any point along these aging pipelines would devastate the Great Lakes.
Now, Chicago is a significant location to be talking about big oil in politics. Earlier this year, Mayor Brandon Johnson's administration filed a lawsuit against BP, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, and Shell, five of the world's largest oil and gas companies, for their role in covering up their role in the climate crisis. The city's lawsuit alleges that these companies are responsible for more frequent and intense storms, flooding, droughts, extreme heat events, and shoreline erosion that's affecting Chicago. This afternoon, WZRD reporters Leslie Lozada and Dan Maurer were on site at McCormick Place for an event called Demopalooza, where freshman Congressperson Maxwell Frost of Florida spoke about his state as a frontline climate change community.
Many of you know right now, the water surrounding the state of Florida is the temperature of a hot tub. That hot water is fuel for hurricanes. Hurricanes now are lasting longer, creating more destruction, killing more people, and displacing more people. My district of Orlando, Florida, received hundreds of thousands of people from the island of Puerto Rico. After Hurricane Maria, those folks had to move to Florida. Those folks are the largest group of climate refugees to move to this country. Not just that, but extreme heat is killing more people than ever before. We are experiencing some of the hottest time periods that we ever had. Did you know that extreme heat is killing more people than hurricanes and tornadoes combined? I'm grateful to Secretary of Labor Julie Sue. They're right now involved in a rulemaking process to provide complete federal preemption of all of these damn states like Florida that took away the heat protections. Can you believe that in the state of Florida? Yeah. Can you believe that in the state of Florida right now, they passed a law that said that cities cannot institute heat protections for their workers?
Frost's remarks are significant because he represents young voters who are increasingly concerned about their environmental future. According to a 2023 study by the Center for Information Research on Civil Learning at Tufts University, concern about climate change directly influences folks age 18 to 34's civic engagement.
And we'll hear more from Congressperson Maxwell Frost of Florida after this. Chicago-based quintet Baumanville with the track Caravan. We just heard Representative Maxwell Alejandro Frost talking today about climate change, and earlier this week he spoke about the symptoms of gun violence and how progressive policies on healthcare and the environment could be used to address the underlying reasons why people pick up a gun in the first place. He talked about how watching school shootings on the news drove him to pursue a career in politics.
I got involved in politics when I was 15 years old for one simple reason. I didn't want to get shot in school. I went to an arts middle school and high school. I was a jazz drummer. My school didn't have a football team, so the jazz band, we were kind of the football team, you know? Before every jazz band concert, my best friends and I would go to this restaurant, load up on a ton of junk food, where they're eating. This silence falls across the restaurant. We look at each other, we look around, we're like, what's going on? And we look at the television screens and we see that somebody walked into an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut, and murdered 20 children and 6 teachers. I was adopted at birth out of a really bad situation. I was raised in South Orlando. It's kind of like the white suburbs of Orlando. Gun violence wasn't really a thing on top of my mind as a kid. But seeing the images of those kids on that television that day really put me in a vulnerable state. And I ended up going to the show that night. I played like one of the worst concerts of my life because I kept looking behind me at the exit signs. I was scared somebody would walk in to that theater and kill my friends, family, and myself. I ended up going to DC for the memorial because I just felt like I needed to be there. So I came up when I was 15 to the memorial. And it was the night of the memorial that I got to meet a guy named Matthew Soto. His sister Vicky was a teacher at Sandy Hook. And when she heard the gunshots, she hid the class, all these kids, in the cabinets. And she was killed while she was doing that. And meeting a guy my age, or he was like a year older than me, meeting a 16-year-old with the demeanor of a 60-year-old crying over his sister who was murdered for just going to class, changed everything about me. I mean, it broke me. And like I told you, my mom was a teacher. So I ran to my hotel room and I called my mom. I was like, Mom, I want to dedicate the rest of my life to making sure people don't have to feel that type of pain I saw in Matthew today.
That was Representative Maxwell Alejandro Frost of Florida speaking at the Progressive Democrats of America conference on Monday. And ending gun violence also appears in the Democratic Platty platform. Now, Governor Tim Walz, who is expected to give the keynote address tonight, has shifted his position on guns over the years, causing him to move from an A rating with the National Rifle Association, or NRA, to an F rating. When Walz was in Congress, his district was in a rural area. At the time, he was a friend to gun owners and ally of the NRA. But in 2018, during his gubernatorial campaign, Walz changed course, saying that the mass shooting in Las Vegas in 2017 led him to support universal background check legislation, along with opposition to conceal and carry legislation before Congress and reducing restrictions on gun silencers, which is what he wrote on Facebook. Then, after the Parkland, Florida shooting, Walz started advocating for assault rifle bans. Now, Walz calls these measures common sense gun changes, and his wife, Gwen Walz, joins him in this. And with that, another topic on the docket for tonight, perhaps another freedom that we're exploring in our third day of DNC coverage. We go live to the convention floor where former President Bill Clinton is speaking, and live to Bob Hennelly, convention correspondent, who is on the floor of the United Center watching that. Hi, Bob.
Hi, so I'm speaking in hushed tones, not to be rude, because everybody is listening to the former president raptured. There was a great affectionate wave of applause here. I started in the New York delegation where Hakeem Jeffries, who minority leader, and this crowd hopes to be speaker. Here we go. So this is...
Oh, what is happening, Bob, there?
That's for adoration. Thank you, Joe. That's been a constant theme throughout this convention, of course. It's funny, I did get to listen to, I guess what you would call a delegation whip over there in New York, directing people in the delegation to say, chant USA, USA at a certain point. And then you do get moved along. They don't want you standing around once you're observing how the sausage is made. So I moved down to Illinois, where I am now.
Oh, all right. The home state. Very nice. Should we take a listen to what former President Clinton is saying?
It's a good moment. It is a good
all right.
Moment.
Here we go. Former President Clinton speaking at the Democratic National case. Convention.
I am too old to gild the lily. 2 days ago, I turned 78, the oldest man in my family for 4 generations. And the only personal vanity I want to assert is I'm still younger than Donald Trump. Last night, in what I thought was a very moving series of episodes, we nominated Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. And just think about that. Two leaders with all American but still improbable life stories. It could only happen here. Their careers, after all, started in community courtrooms and classrooms. Two leaders who spent a lifetime getting the good job done. Now, one of the things that I've noticed over my increasingly long life that a presidential election is unique in several ways. First of all, it's the greatest job interview for the greatest job in the world. Secondly, the Constitution says we, the people, get to do the hiring. And the third thing is that every 4 years, we get to change the requirements for the job. So here's what I'm thinking, because I try to apply this in every election. Will this president take us backward or forward? Will this president give our kids a brighter future? Depends. Will this president bring us together or tear us apart? Will the president increase the peace, security, and stability and freedom that we enjoy and extend it to others as we can? We, the people, we have to make a decision about these kind of questions. And every 4 years, it's a little different because the people come at the candidates, and they say, as they're saying now, here are our problems, solve them. Here are our opportunities, seize them. Here are our fears, ease them. Here are our dreams. Help them come true.
All right, that's former President Bill Clinton speaking about the importance of freedom, the theme of tonight. And for more, we go back to our convention correspondent who must be running back and forth, Bob Hennelly. Hi, Bob.
Hi. So this is amazing. The president is holding this hall to the point that you can have to speak in a whisper, because I don't want to be rude. These people are totally wrapped here, which is the kind of, I think, the staying power of his oratory capability and his sense of humor.
There's one important thing that President Clinton brought up that I want to ask you, Bob. Do you share a birthday with him?
No. What? August 18th? I don't think so.
Oh, I thought he mentioned 2 days ago. Okay.
Maybe.
That's a very important point. Okay.
But still, the same sign. I mean, Gen Z would care about the fact that I think you're both Leos.
We'll have to ask Congressman Frost. All right. All right. We're going to take a break. We're going to go back to more talking about the issues at stake during the 2024 presidential election while we're at the DNC. But, Bob, we want you to watch President Clinton and report back to us very soon, okay?
I may be timed out, so I may have to rotate out and change the pass.
Okay. Good luck with that. All right. We're going to move along to another freedom. The freedom to be healthy. Firefighters and paramedics here in the Chicago area are in a protracted contract negotiation and fight with the city. They've been working without a contract for over 3 years. Now, members of the Chicago Firefighters Union Local 2 have been protesting this week, tapping into the energy from the DNC as they attempt to make their message heard nationally. While they applied twice for a permit to protest during the DNC, they say their request was denied both times by Mayor
Brandon Johnson's administration. And while the city cited proximity to the DNC perimeter and access to resources as reasons, Pat Cleary, president of Chicago Firefighters Union Local 2, who's been a firefighter for 37 years, says that there are other reasons the permits were denied. Now, Cleary talked to WLPNLP reporters August Abitang and Ariandi Luna about why firefighters and EMS have turned to protest.
We've been negotiating with the city. We're not getting anywhere, and so we're out here expressing our displeasure with the city, basically.
Now, Clary says they're negotiating to get the resources that they need.
We don't have enough ambulances. We only have 80. We want it to go up to 100. And then we also need a thing called battalion chief aides, which are communication assistants. So they assist the chief at a fire, because the chief at a fire has to listen to two radios, and sometimes he'll miss a transmission because he's talking on another channel. And if he misses a mayday, which happened not too long ago and someone died, well, that's important, don't you think? So you should have another person there listening to that radio so that doesn't happen. So that's what we're trying to get through in negotiations.
Cleary spoke to the complexities of negotiating with a city headed by a progressive mayor, Mayor Brandon Johnson, formerly an organizer teacher with the Chicago Teachers Union.
You know, it's a pro-labor town. It's a pro-labor mayor. We're a pro-labor organization. Give us a contract. Why do we have to wait 3 years? We're shorthanded. We need help. We need manpower. When firemen die at a fire, the answer to that is not to have less firemen. The answer is you need more firemen so that doesn't happen.
Firefighters and EMS told ABC Chicago shortly after the graduation of some new paramedics earlier this summer that they still need more paramedics to join the ranks, and they're close to a crisis point without reinforcement. Union officials are also urging for more pay for paramedics to take on supervisory roles. In cities across the country, EMS providers face low funding and staffing that's made their jobs increasingly difficult.
But Jenna, it's not only cities. It's also rural areas. Mm-hmm. Take Wisconsin, my home state. For years, EMS providers, that's the people that we describe who respond in an ambulance when you call 911, they've described staffing shortages and funding gaps, even in EMS departments that are volunteer-based. Those gaps have stretched so thin that in some areas of the state, it's putting communities at risk, that someone may not show up when you call 911. In 2023, a study from the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health found that more than 40% of state EMS agencies had staffing gaps where no ambulance was available to respond in an emergency. The same study found that almost four-fifths of EMS agencies in Wisconsin were called to cover emergencies in a neighboring community, stretching resources further. And while state lawmakers have considered some interventions, like lowering standards in order to be certified, it's a tougher sell for the theme to intervene with funding or other policy changes. They've declined to list EMS as an essential service, which allows better flexibility and more funding for the agencies.
And according to the industry website EMS1, just over a dozen states and the District of Columbia have passed laws designated or allowing local governments to deem EMS an essential service. That is shocking. I would assume that would be an essential service. Mm-hmm. That's according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, a think tank that's been tracking legislation around the issue. It's one example of the structural issues in life-saving healthcare and, well, essential services that people in both rural and urban settings are facing. Yesterday, Pacifica's Bob Henley spoke with Ty Pinkins, a Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate in Mississippi. And they spoke about the rural caucus meeting describing the intersection of healthcare access and democratic outreach to voters and potential voters in rural areas.
Now, we're here at a rural council. Can you talk about how essential mobilizing rural voters are in the race you're running?
It's absolutely essential. I don't think Republicans win races in states like Mississippi. I think Democrats lose races in Mississippi, places like Mississippi, because we don't reach out to rural communities where there are so many voters available to candidates like myself. If we'll just show up and talk to them about the policies and the issues that we're going to be fighting for, public school education, health care, keeping our hospitals open, women's reproductive freedom, all of those issues are applicable to people in rural communities.
Now, one of the things that a survey was done of voters in 2016, and it was found that by Columbia University, a majority of low-wealth and low-wealth voters did not turn out. When they were asked why not, they said they didn't hear their issues discussed. This is something Reverend Barbara refers to. How did Democrats have a conversation with those voters that's meaningful to get them to engage and feel agency enough to vote?
You know what? One of the things that I'm proud of in my campaign, I've been doing this for 19 months now. I started in January 2023, and I visited all 82 counties in the state of Mississippi with the motto, you talk, I listen, and we do. So I've knocked on doors, gone into barbershops, into schools, so that community members can talk to me and tell me what issues are important to them, and I can explain to them how I plan to address those issues. Yeah, and if I don't know the answer to the issue, I tell them on the spot, and we sit down and we figure it out together. And they respect that. They appreciate that. But I think the thing that most rural community members appreciate is somebody asking them for their vote. Asking them, can I have your vote? And for so long, they haven't seen that. I can't count the number of people, 40, 50, 60 years old.
You're listening to We Decide, America at the Crossroads, live coverage of the Democratic National Convention. We turn to the right of democracy, free from corporate interest or even more corporate interest, and we turn to Nina Turner, who ran to represent Ohio's 11th congressional district in 2021 and 2022, but lost in both primaries to the more moderate candidate, Democratic U.S. Representative Chantel Brown. Now, Turner lost after the pro-Israel lobbying group AIPAC donated tens of thousands of dollars to her opponent. That's according to campaign finance records. And Turner told an audience at the Progressive Central Conference that we heard about earlier that her unsuccessful bids for Congress should act as a canary in the coal mine for other progressive candidates about the threat of dark money. And she joins us now on the line. Nina Turner, welcome and thank you for being here. It looks like we don't have Nina Turner on the line. Nina Turner, are you there? All right. Well, while she joins us, we are going to move to a related topic about the uncommitted delegates and the role of dark money, AIPAC, and the uncommitted campaign. So also last night, Jana, we have so many contributors here. Last night at the convention, Nick Wiley of Chicago's Public Media Institute, where we are, spoke with Michael Berg, one of three uncommitted delegates from Missouri. Now, Wiley asked Berg about how the uncommitted delegates are shifting Democratic policy and the growing support for an arms embargo to Israel. Berg responded saying that the ceasefire message isn't working.
Biden's been saying ceasefire for months, and Netanyahu, if he has the firepower, he won't cease using it. He will not stop. So you can't say ceasefire and keep sending the fire unceasingly if you want to have an actual ceasefire. Just this night, they've intensified their mass murder of Palestinians.
All right. And Dan Engelhart, an uncommitted delegate from Waltz's home state of Minnesota, says that he voted for a journalist at the roll call.
I voted for a journalist. I voted for Ismail Al-Ghul, who is an Al Jazeera journalist who was clearly targeted by Israel in an airstrike. One of 165 journalists that has been killed by Israel since October. So that is the piece of paper I held up today was in honor of him, and that is who I voted for when I voted president, our virtual roll call. And it's really weird to be here and see people just want to party and have a good time and feel good when the USA has been funding a genocide with displacement and starvation and disease. How can we be partying and feeling good? And how can we actually be confident about winning in November? And what so many people say their largest priority is saving democracy. If we can't protest the genocide and the funding of it and the arming of a genocide, what democracy are we saving?
All right. That's uncommitted delegates interviewed yesterday on the floor of the United Center. And joining us now, we do have Nina Turner from Ohio. Nina, thank you so much for joining us. Ms. Turner, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
We appreciate your time so much. So tell us more about what you talked about at the Progressive Central Conference, the role of dark money in your campaign and others.
Yeah, I mean, we really do have to educate the average American voter about the impact, the disruption, and the corruption of dark money in campaigns. As you all know, dark money played a very pivotal role in defeating my congressional run in the great state of Ohio in 21 and 22. The same forces took out Congressman Bowman in New York and also Congresswoman Cori Bush in St. Louis. And we know those two races happened about, you know, a little less than a month ago. And it really takes away the ability of the community to be able to choose their own leaders. And it has a particularly chilling effect on Black communities. So AIPAC, DMFI, all of those kind of affiliated organizations came after me, came after Congressman Bowman, Congressman Bush, all because we said Palestinian lives should matter. But it's not just AIPAC and DMFI. It is dark money across the board. So whether we're talking about the National Rifle Association or the National Restaurant Association, Big Pharma, I just want your listeners to understand that dark money is a corrupting force, and it tips the scale not towards the interests of those people who live, work, and play in those specific districts. It tips the scale in favor of whatever that interest group wants to happen.
Nina Turner, Citizens United, the Supreme Court case that enabled much of dark money to continue, although that's been around since Buckley v. Valeo, but that's been around for almost 15 years now. Have you noticed the political landscape change as we've spent nearly a decade and a half with more unregulated and less transparency in campaign finance?
Not necessarily to the good. I guess if I were to point there is a little more awareness, especially among what I would call activist groups who are being laser focused on the impact of the role of dark money. But when I think about like the average American probably does not know. And so we who care about these issues have to do a better job. There have been some members of Congress who have introduced legislation to try to get dark money out. But the Congress, by and large, both Republicans and Democrats, really refuse to regulate themselves in this way because most of them are controlled by the owner donors. There is no other way to describe it. And it again, disrupts and corrupts the democratic process. So there are more ways, you know, Donald Trump is not the only threat to democracy. Dark money is a threat to democracy.
Also wondering, do you think that the large demonstrations at the DNC are going to have an impact? I mean, you know, people say, okay, well, you're having a demonstration and you're getting arrested, whatever, but all you're really doing is just being a nuisance. You're being a disruption. Do you think that there's actually something that's taking place?
I do think it will have an impact. It might not necessarily impact the people who are in this arena today. It might not have impacted, you know, the people when the Republicans had their convention. But as we know, taking a page out of the civil rights movement, disruption and marching and lifting voices and having solidarity and this collective consciousness does work. Sometimes we get instant results. Sometimes it takes years, sometimes even decades, but we're building. We really are. Those who are humanitarians, those who are pro-peace, anti-war, those who believe that everyday citizens in this country deserve to live a good life, just like our sisters and brothers around the world. When we come together, we are moving the levers of justice. Again, sometimes slow, sometimes quick. I want to applaud, and I'm glad that you brought them up, you know, Cold Pink, Jewish Voices for Peace, Uncommitted. It may feel in the moment like what they are doing is not having an impact, but it is having an impact. And we will ultimately win, but there are sacrifices along the way. Unfortunately, we saw sacrifices in the civil rights movement. We glorify the civil rights movement, but we know that white supremacy killed a lot of Black freedom fighters. Medgar Evers got gunned down in his driveway. The Reverend Dr. Jr. assassinated. Minister Malcolm X assassinated. People knocked over the head, losing their lives and their livelihoods, but they continue to push. And that push brought us the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and other great human interest policies that shook the world. The same thing is going to happen because of the uncommitted movement. The same thing is going to happen. And I applaud those sisters and brothers for putting their literal bodies on the line.
Nina Turner, we heard yesterday from about the first panel on, I believe, Palestinian human rights. And one of the organizers, we played a clip of one of the organizers at that panel invoking the words of Fannie Lou Hamer. Were you at that panel?
No, I was not at that panel, but I heard all about it. I was at a panel that was hosted by Dr. Jim Zogby, with Congressman Andy Levin, who we know was a victim of the AIPAC DMFI money, and also a chairwoman from the state of Nevada, and Judith Whitmer. And we had a really deep talk about the impact of dark money and the things that we must do. And one of the things that we have to do, besides being out in the streets and pushing for justice, is to start to elect officials on the federal level in particular who will be in support of a ban on dark money.
All right. I know you need to go. Sorry,
go ahead. We know that.
Okay. Well, before you go, we want to ask you. You were at the Progressive Center conference. You have a progressive bona fides. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz is sort of a aw shucks progressive. I'm wondering if you would characterize him as a progressive because he extols some policies, but he does it in a sort of wearing a baseball cap way. What's your impression? Of Governor Tim Walz, who's expected to speak tonight.
As an administrator, he has shown how you can have a social contract with the people who live in your state, from the breakfast and lunch program to, you know, paid family medical leave. So he has shown through his actions. He might not necessarily label himself as a progressive, but you better believe that the policies that he has championed and pushed are because of the progressive movement. And most Americans, I mean, I want your listeners to understand, most Americans are where the progressive movement is. They just might not label themselves that. But when you talk to Americans, you know that Medicare for All polls high, paid family medical leave polls high. You know, 60% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. They want something done. They want big money out. They want a wealth tax. So the American people and progressives, we in lockstep. The only outliers are neoliberals and neo-fascists. So we're going to keep on pushing for a human rights economy that lifts all people in this country and gives them the opportunity to live out their greatest greatness while keeping an eye on what is happening in the world. Charity starts at home, but it must spread abroad. So we who believe in freedom cannot rest. That is Ella Baker. And it's been a pleasure, and I hope to get to join you all again. Thank you so much for tackling this subject. It means a lot. The people like me who have been the victims of dark money.
Thank you so much for joining us, Nina Turner. Nina Turner talking about what freedom means to her as she joins us live. She ran to represent Ohio's 11th congressional district in 2021 and 2022. She lost both primaries to the more moderate candidate, a victim, she says, of dark money. Now, we want to go to a clip that she addressed, that she was speaking to a crowd at the Progressive Conference on the Progressive Central Conference on Sunday and Monday, and she addressed Project 2025, calling for progressives to create their own policy agenda that would include health care for all, paid medical leave for all, and raising the minimum wage. So we want to go to that clip here.
I am saying that we should not let the elites of the Democratic Party fearmonger us about Project 2025. My question is, where is their Project 2025? Hello? We mad at the Republicans. The Urban Core Tupac said, don't hate the player, hate the game. Where is their Project 2025? We just said it for all the progressives and did all the work. We said health care for all, pay college for all, pay family medical leave for all, raise the federal minimum wage in the United States of America. We did all the work. See, it's one thing to hate on the other side. Project 2025 is horrible. No doubt about it, will take us back as a nation, but you don't fight against it by complaining about it. You fight against it by having policies of your own.
Now, Senator Turner, or Turner asserted strong, yeah, that was close, asserted strong union leaders like the ones on the panel supported their sisters and brothers who don't have the benefit of a union.
And if the House of Labor has to stand in the gap for all workers in the United States of America, not just those who have the benefit of the union, because most of our sisters and brothers and family and friends do not have the benefit of the union, and that is why they need union leaders like the ones who are up here now who say, we will not leave a sister or a brother behind.
This is We Decide, America at the Crossroads on the third night of the DNC. And we go now to convention correspondent Bob, who is Jenna. I hear no longer on the floor.
No, I actually found, you won't believe this, a sports bar where your money's no good here. The host committee will give you whatever you need.
All right.
So it's
well,
a kind of cool place. You can listen to Bill Clinton and have a sports bar atmosphere, and the place is packed. And everybody's having a high-spirited time.
Is there an open bar? Are there multiple open bars?
No,
really? All around?
No, I'm just saying, this is the one I found. I gave them a slip at the door. I technically shouldn't be in here, but I am. And I'm not drinking, really.
So I found this interesting because they're giving pretty much anything that you need, but I'm assuming if you walk in and ask for health care, they're not ready to give you that yet.
They are not. they're not giving you any kind of handguns. But it's funny because there's people that I thought are serious politicians who are hanging in here, drinking and kind of keeping one eye on President Clinton or whatever. Oh, Speaker Pelosi is on now.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this woman nodded. There's actually a woman who nodded out over here. I don't know if, well, I shouldn't talk to her.
Oh, well, listen, they're human too, and they're probably having a good old time.
Right.
I see her mentioning the cost of prescription drugs. Bob, you listened to President Clinton's speech. What did he have to say?
Well, he kept it very much focused on just how absolutely out of the norm former President Trump is. And I think that particularly the music that was behind when he came on and off, they really got into a kind of nostalgia feeling. For a lot of people, Bill Clinton represents a kind of, you know, Democrat getting, being successful, having, you know, the full presidency. But the reality is also, for a lot of union households, that Clinton presidency spelled NAFTA, and it spelled world trade, and a kind of abandonment of the FDR coalition, because the Democratic Party got itself very much involved with multinational corporations. And, of course, the Rust Belts all sold out because they were.
Mm. Bob, we heard, I don't know if you caught it, but we were talking with Nina Turner right before we went to you and hearing some, she's amazing. And then we were going to some clips from her that she was speaking earlier this week. And she, in the second to last clip, she made the point that Democrats do not have their own policy document that's akin to the Republicans and Project 2025, even as they've disavowed. I'm wondering how much you've heard about Project 2025 tonight from all the speakers that you've witnessed, and if you have any comment on that idea of this kind of lack of a policy document that is 900 pages long and extremely substantive.
Well, I think that we know that once you have a policy document, that means you stand for something. And if you're trying to raise hundreds of millions of dollars at the same time from corporate interests, what you want to do is create kind of like the caricature of 2025, which I'm sure is terrible, but has very little chance of being implemented. And that actually makes it easier to drive negatives. But the idea of articulating exactly what a labor-friendly United States might look like beyond the PRO Act, you're right. That's a heavy lift, because it means that you're going to have some lobbyists get upset. For instance, you notice that the Democrats talk about the drug of the day, Ozempic, we're going to get it for you better. It's incrementalism. It doesn't talk about the fact that American health care in urban and rural settings and even in suburbia is in crisis. It is imploding. 26 million Americans were thrown off of Medicaid. And that was with this Democratic administration signing an executive order that said the pandemic was over. Certainly the Republican states bear a burden for that. But imagine all that progress we made and 26 million Americans thrown off Medicaid. What does that mean? That means you're getting back to the fact that here in America, sadly, poverty is the fourth leading cause of death. We can do better than that.
So this seems like a great opportunity. I mean, since we've seen so much use of props for perhaps AOC to bound and cover that Green New Deal of hers.
That would be a great idea. And they should make it that as large as the 2025 prop so that
there you
the
go.
Industry right. can see it coming.
Tote that thing around everywhere.
Okay. As we wrap up, Bob, from the floor, Governor Tim Walz is set to accept the nomination to be the and to give the biggest speech of his life tonight. What have you heard from folks on the floor about Governor Walz?
Well, I've heard from rural Democrats who have felt in isolation that finally they feel a leverage point. And so one of the things is that I guess the folks that have been trying to keep the home fires burning in rural areas, what they'll tell you is that it's not that Republicans win these red rural states and these rural neighborhoods, but that Democrats don't show up. And so that's why you have a situation which is kind of incomprehensible, that right now Speaker Johnson, who is in line succession for the presidency, who leads the Republican caucus, who was the architect of the insurrection done by not certifying the Electoral College after the violence that we saw recounted tonight, has no opponent from the Democratic Party in that Louisiana district in the Northwest. And it's our hope we could go down there and start talking to those people. How did it happen? Is that what democracy looks like in 2024? No opposition because nobody's got the guts to take it to where these folks are?
Well, Bob Hennelly, we have to go as former Speaker Nancy Pelosi, current representative, exits the stage. We will have more for you tomorrow in our final night of We Decide America at the Crossroads. But we have to go now as we are in anticipation of Governor Walz's speech tonight. That does it for tonight's show. Our technical crew is Keziah Glow, Reggie Johnson, Charlie Garcia, and Mo Thomas. Thanks also to Stephanie Manriquez, Nick Wiley, Dennis Sagal, and John Almella. Reporters include Bill Morton, Trudy Leong, Dan Maurer, Leslie Lozada, Bill Ayers, Rylan Pietras, and Zachariah Simmons. They also include August Abitang, Ariandi Luna, Todd Carter, and music producers are Bill Morton and also Todd Carter. This evening's senior producer is Sarah Gabler. Senior reporters are Faye Parks and Carlos Davalos.
Shali Pittman is our editorial director and co-host of this broadcast.
And your fabulous co-host is, my fabulous co-host is Jenna Flanagan. Reporting live from the United Center was our convention correspondent, veteran labor journalist Bob Hennelly, executive director of We Decide America at the Crossroads. Jenna, should I take a crack at the funding credits? Is it my turn?
I think you can.
All right. The Pacifica Radio Network's national coverage is supported by sustaining sponsorships from unions representing close to 2 million rank-and-file members, including the American Federation of Government Employees, representing 750,000 federal workers in all 50 states, 1199 SEIU, the largest union of healthcare workers in the nation, representing 450,000 members, 32BJ, SEIU, America's largest building service union, representing more than 175,000 workers in 11 states, and Washington, D.C. Transport Workers Union of America, representing 155,000 workers. Communication Workers of America, NJ, representing 70,000 public and private sector workers. The United Steelworkers Local 4200, representing nurses at Robert Wood Johnson University Hospital in New Brunswick, New Jersey. New Jersey's HPAE, representing 14,000 nurses and allied healthcare professionals. New York Metro Area Postal Union. The U.S. Postal Police Officers Association. The Environmental Police Benevolent Association, representing the men and women who protect New York City's vast watershed system, New York Metro Area Postal Union, APWU, AFL-CIO, DC-37, Local 3621, FDNY EMS officers, and New York City Organization of Public Service Retirees. Broadcasting from Lumpen Radio, WLPNLP 105.5 Chicago, I'm Shali Pittman.
And I'm Jenna Flanagan. This is a project of Lumpin' Radio along with WZRD 88.3 Chicago, WBAI 99.5 New York, and WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
Join us here tomorrow at the same time, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 to 9 p.m. Central. We'll see you then. Have a good night.